May it please the court, good afternoon. Patrick Collins and Catherine Garrison here on behalf of appellant Gary Plouffe. As the court is aware, Mr. Plouffe is currently a death sentenced inmate. This is an appeal of the lower court's denial of his motion for post-conviction relief. With the court's permission, I'm going to focus my presentation on the penalty phase claims in this appeal. Your Honors, six former foster children who lived in the Plouffe home during Gary Plouffe's formative years came forward at the evidentiary hearing and testified. And this is some of the evidence about the Plouffe foster home.
The evidentiary hearing on the Rule 61?
Yes, sir. They did not testify at trial, although they were certainly available to. These women came forward and testified, and this is what the jury never heard in this case. Mr. Plouffe's father and mother beat him frequently. Foster girls testified that he would be taken down to the basement and beaten with a belt. His mother also struck him. The foster girls remember him being pushed down flights of stairs. Gary's mother did not do anything about it and just pretended that what was happening in the basement wasn't happening. In Gary's presence, his parents would fight constantly with a lot of physical altercations between the parents. Mr. Plouffe has a brother, not a foster brother, but a family brother, who was severely mentally and physically handicapped. And all the foster children tell that he was also physically abused, most particularly by Mr. Plouffe's mother.
Mr. Collins,
yes,
the facts that you're reciting to us and the related facts that are set forth in your brief,
yes,
they were all presented to the trial judge in the Rule 61 proceeding?
Yes, he presided over the hearing, and his holding, in essence, is captured in one sentence, which is to the effect of one couldn't say that the prolonged testimony of the foster children, even if presented, would have made any difference. And that's a holding that we certainly disagree with, especially with respect to all the sexual abuse of the foster girls that took place, which all the women testified about, but variously as to whether it was fondling or rape or behavior in between at the hands of Mr. Plouffe's father towards these foster children. It was done in the presence of Gary Plouffe and certainly covered up. All this behavior was covered up. The girls have testified that when social services or the adoption foster authorities would come around, they would, as the testimony went, portray themselves as a Leave It to Beaver sort of family with everything perfect. And then,
can we assume for the sake of argument that your facts are correct in that respect, and all of these horrific facts that come from their testimony at the Rule 61 hearing were before the judge at the Rule 61 hearing? And you've indicated his response to that was rather pithy. Did he give any explanation for his conclusion that it would not have made any difference in this case?
Or just a
statement it would not have made any difference?
No, it was really just a one-sentence statement, Your Honor, and that's why we're asking that this court do what has been done previously in Norcross and Swan, and that is to order a remand of this case back to the trial court so that the trial court can evaluate and reweigh all the evidence, the aggravating evidence, and all the cumulative total of the mitigating evidence. And as in Norcross and Swan, we would ask that the remand order seek a review of this evidence in light of Williams and Wiggins and Outen and German and Porter versus McCollum and all the cases which make abundantly clear that an an inadequate investigation does not lead to reasonable strategic choices. And further, evidence of abuse of this nature, pervasive, systemic abuse of this nature, does make a difference to a determination of a capital murder defendant's moral culpability for the crime that he was just found guilty of committing.
Could you refresh my memory as to what the jury vote was on that?
It was 12-0, and it took about, they reached a verdict that, it was a two-day penalty phase. They reached a verdict at 8:30 at night on the second day. They asked to be able to stay. They said they would need about 3 hours. So it was a short penalty phase. The aggravating evidence was the significant prior planning and the nature of the crime against a defenseless victim. Mitigating evidence, ironically, Your Honor, Mr. Plouffe's mother actually came to the evidentiary hearing and testified. But because counsel was completely unprepared and never, they just shut down their investigation, despite being told by their mitigation specialist, I wonder what went on in that foster home.
Well, they had information that the foster home was shut down, quote, involuntarily, close quote.
Trial counsel did not.
Well, isn't the evidence...
Trial counsel did not have that information?
No, Your Honor. That was uncovered by post-conviction counsel.
I'm confused then, because I think this is a difficult part of the record. What I understand is, I guess, Zervis, who was the investigator, testified that she was in possession of a report. Bless you. Was in possession of a report, at a page of which said that the home had been shut down, but she didn't recall in her testimony whether she had caught that. And it would be helpful to me, at least, for you to talk about, is that your understanding? And which were the reports? There seemed to be State's Exhibit 1 was the one I thought that was supposedly in the possession of the trial team but was not focused upon, that actually said that the home had been shut down. And then there were two other reports. One was Defense Exhibit 23 and Defense Exhibit 24, which seemed to highlight problems. And I'm not clear from the record whether that was in the possession of the trial team or not.
Okay. Your Honor, I can review the record. I was not a post-conviction counsel in this case. I came on board for the appeal, so I can certainly review the record and correct myself if I'm wrong. My recollection is what Ms. Zervis testified to is they did have that, what they called a social services report. But the document that Dr. Mensch testified to at the evidentiary hearing or that Ms. Zervis testified to came into their possession was that was a shutdown due to sexual improprieties, in essence, was not in trial counsel's possession.
Well, maybe I dreamed this, but I thought that one of the more significant points that appellant was trying to make here was that there was information before trial counsel or the trial team that suggested that the foster home had been shut down involuntarily and that the best evidence of ineffective assistance of counsel was the investigation did not explore the basis for that. And had it explored the basis for that, they would have discovered before the penalty hearing that the basis was abuse in the home. Did I just dream that? That's not a fact?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that that's the case.
Well, that's not the case. What puts defense counsel at the trial level, the trial counsel, on notice to go beyond and investigate this and find this mitigation evidence and present it at the penalty hearing?
Two things. One was that they knew that Mr. Plouffe was in a foster home with a total of 33 foster children, not all together, of course, but over a period of years, two, three, four at a time, and also that he had a severely handicapped brother. And Dr. Stephen Mechanic, who evaluated Mr. Plouffe for trial counsel, raised the flag with trial counsel and said that the foster home should be further looked into, what sort of circumstances he grew up in. And Ms. Zervis sent an email, that's Linda Zervis, the mitigation person, sent an email to trial counsel saying, I wonder what really went on in that foster home. Trial counsel contacted, this is the second thing, trial counsel contacted the Plouffe parents by phone who said nothing was amiss, etc. What happened next was that Mr. Plouffe, by that I mean Gerald Plouffe, Gary's father, called Ms. Zervis back and said, I'm trying to decide whether I should tell you about it. And then he kind of chickened out, for lack of a better word, and said he needed to talk to his wife more before deciding whether to talk about it, whatever it was. And what happened was trial counsel, and this was reported to trial counsel by the mitigation person, and trial counsel didn't do anything about it. They never sought to, a basic function in a mitigation case preparation is obtaining records. They never sent any releases or anything to the foster home, to my knowledge, to obtain records from the foster home with respect to anything. Now, I'll correct the record if I'm not accurate about information being in possession, as Chancellor Strine suggested, if it's in that social services report. But
did your client say anything about having been mistreated as a child?
No.
And he specifically denied that?
He specifically denied. As a matter of fact, the word he used was perfect, that his childhood was perfect. And there was testimony at the evidentiary hearing. I don't even know how necessary the testimony was, because it would be fairly intuitive to most people that if a person had a horrific upbringing, that they observed their parents covering up for years, then they would also be inclined to do so. Victims of abuse, as the testimony indicated, are also very prone to being in denial about it and its effects in later years. So the problem with this case is when they got the answer of perfect from Gary Plouffe and everything was fine from Gary Plouffe's parents, in essence, they didn't go any further. They just shut the investigation down.
But after the other six foster children testified, did your client still say, oh, no, that didn't happen to me?
Well, he didn't testify at the evidentiary hearing, Your Honor. The six now adults, foster children, who testified at the evidentiary hearing were not trial witnesses.
No, I understand. I'm just saying that if it started out where he denied having had problems as a child, and then evidence is brought in from other foster children that they saw him being beaten, and that he saw sexual acts being perpetrated on the female children, nobody ever went back to him and said, well, listen, you know, you may have been uncomfortable about talking about this, but there's evidence now that you were beaten a lot. Is that true? Nobody ever did that?
He didn't testify at the evidentiary hearing, Your Honor, and whether he had, because the evidentiary hearing focused on trial counsel's claims of ineffectiveness and prejudice, whether he had a private discussion with his then counsel at the evidentiary hearing, that would have been Ms. Aronson, Ms. Garrison, etc., then I'm not privy to that private conversation. The record doesn't reflect that he took the stand and testified and said, now I'd like to say that that did all happen, or I categorically deny that any of it happened. He just didn't testify at the evidentiary hearing, which is the norm.
How does it affect the Strickland analysis that your client insisted on presenting a rather unique guilt defense?
I think
in terms of analyzing whether how far counsel should have gone in doing a mitigation investigation. Because counsel's got to make choices about what it spends time on. Your client didn't choose to come in and say, I committed the crime. I want you to consider my whole life in terms of how you – that isn't what the hand counsel got to play, right? Your client said, I didn't do this. My wife killed herself.
I think it is – it is an important factor to consider, but really only heightened trial counsel's burden to find mitigation evidence that would humanize Mr. Plouffe in front of the jury when they had to make their decision about moral culpability. And what's ironic is that it was there.
How would it have humanized him if they believed he falsely claimed that his wife committed suicide if they had concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that he intentionally killed her?
Because what the jury never got to hear, Your Honor, is that he spent his entire childhood watching his parents being abusive, being sexually abusive. There was evidence that his father had an affair with a 16-year-old babysitter, which caused a lot of fisticuffs between Mr. Plouffe's parents, and they covered it up. As a matter of fact, at trial, when Mrs. Plouffe, Gary's mom, took the stand, he got up and left. He didn't want to be present. And even under oath at her son's penalty hearing, she still was covering it up. So that's why I would argue that it would have humanized her, at least allowed the jury to understand the defense and the reasons for the defense is, as this court has held many times, most recently last year, mitigation is not excuses. Your Honor?
I want to make sure I understand your comment that at the penalty hearing, Mrs. Plouffe, the mother, still covered it up. Do you mean she was asked about child abuse in the home?
No. No.
She just didn't volunteer it?
She didn't volunteer it.
Okay.
To follow up on the court's questions about the strategy in the guilt phase and the penalty phase, and as we've seen in the briefs, you've raised questions about whether the victim was left-handed or her daughters testified to that effect. There were photographs of her using her left hand. Arguments made they should have gotten an expert to rebut Dr. Tobin. And when the trial counsel was asked about why they didn't pursue the suicide defense more vigorously, they said, quote, "You can't present a defense that's so ridiculous that the jury, you lose your credibility." And then goes on to say you need to preserve your credibility for the penalty phase. So what's perplexing, given this record, is it appears trial counsel didn't really get behind the suicide defense and was saving credibility, so to speak, for the penalty phase, and yet didn't pursue this mitigation evidence. So I guess your argument is if they weren't going to get behind the suicide defense and they were going to save their credibility for the penalty phase, they should have done a thorough mitigation defense and focused on the penalty phase if they weren't going to focus on the guilt phase.
I agree, Your Honor, and that does leave the record in kind of a state, but that would have been a more reasonable strategy. But again, we get back to the holdings in Wiggins and Outen, is that it's hard to make, well, impossible to make reasonable strategic choices when you haven't done a thorough enough investigation.
It's correct that in the series of cases that you've mentioned, and now you've mentioned a few of them again, you weren't dealing with a 12-0 death penalty vote, and you weren't dealing with a aggravated factor of pecuniary gain. Is that correct? I'm trying to find a way to understand the Rule 61 trial judge's pithy conclusion that this mitigation evidence, as awful as it sounds in the abstract, in the context of this entire case, the 12-0 vote, the pecuniary gain, the absurd story that was offered as a defense, it would not have made any difference. You find any analogy to any of the cases that you're cited that face the rather daunting prospect of a 12-0 vote and a case tried for on the basis of pecuniary gain?
Not necessarily for pecuniary gain that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but I will say that there's a lot of horrific murders that were premeditated and planned. I mean, German stabbed his mother and set her on fire. Wiggins killed someone in a bathtub, a 77-year-old lady. All murders are bad, and whether it's pecuniary gain or the horrific nature of the evidence of the murder, that doesn't alleviate the trial counsel's obligation to find the mitigation.
I'm not raising a question about whether there was a deficiency or not in the investigation. I'm trying to explore the Rule 61 judge's, I keep using the word pithy, but rather clear and unelaborated conclusion that, given the facts of this case, understanding all of your mitigation evidence, when I weigh it against what I heard at the guilt phase, what I heard at the penalty phase, a 12-0 vote, pecuniary gain, it's not the kind of evidence that's going to be set off cleanly as it would in maybe an emotional, irrational kind of outrageous, you use the word horrific, murder. It was some that couldn't be explained other than perhaps by a horrible childhood. But this is for money.
Right. Your Honor, all I can say is that it should be remanded to give the trial judge an opportunity to review it in light of the six or so cases that were mentioned in the Norcross remand. And I think that would provide a better context of how important abuse evidence is.
Well, just to follow up more precisely on what the Chief Justice was asking you, and I think we all want to know, it is clear that the Rule 61 judge rejected whatever argument, whatever mitigation argument counsel made based on the parental abuse evidence, correct?
Yes.
What is not clear is the argument that was made by defense counsel and rejected. That is, what was the articulation that connected the parental abuse history with the bottom line, which is that the penalty, the punishment, should be mitigated?
Well, the evidence, Your Honor, was that there was evidence that people who have been abused and in denial about it or covering up and things like that, it can manifest itself in adulthood and give the jury a better understanding of what Mr. Plouffe's moral culpability, even given the pecuniary gain motivation. That's the argument that was made. And the problem is,
so the
12-0 is...
He was an abused child. Yes, he committed murder one, but he shouldn't be executed for it because he had a bad childhood?
And other things. But I, in all due respect, I don't think bad childhood does the actual experience justice.
Do you want to save what?
I'm well into my rebuttal, so if I could save the rest, if the court doesn't have any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, I'll address the second argument because that's primarily what's been focused on, but if any members of the court have questions about the other two arguments in the briefs, I'll certainly attempt to try to answer any of those questions as well. The argument that's been presented concerns primarily six of 33 foster children who were at the Plouffe home in Poughkeepsie, New York at various times while Gary Plouffe was growing up. It is true that the home was eventually shut down by the New York State authorities. I think that happened around 1984. At the time the home was closed, Gary Plouffe was approximately 20 years of age and was serving in the United States Air Force, so he was not home at the time that the actual closing occurred. The evidence presented at the Rule 61 evidentiary hearing was from these six of these foster children, some of whom claim they had been sexually abused not by Gary Plouffe, the defendant, but by his father, Gerald. At least two of the testifying foster children or former foster children said they had witnessed physical abuse of Gary Plouffe by his father, Gerald, that Mr. Plouffe had struck his son, Gary, on occasion, and that they were witnesses to that. One of the foster children testified that I think Gary had exposed himself to her when he was approximately 12 or 13 years of age, and she was older.
Well, Mr. Williams, I think that we're all aware of the facts that were presented relating to this history of parental abuse. But the question, the argument that's being made to us, or one of them, is that the opinion of the Rule 61 Superior Court judge doesn't reflect that there was any weighing of that evidence against the aggravating circumstances, and that at the very least we should remand the case so that the judge is given the opportunity to not only to weigh that evidence but to explain in writing what the weighing process is. What is your response to that argument?
Well, I think what the judge said, and it is fairly brief, he says, first, it cannot be said that their performance fell below the standard of reasonableness. That's the first prong of Strickland, ineffective assistance. And then the second part of it, addressing the prejudice prong, he says, nor can it be said that any of the prolonged foster child information probably could have made an impact even if presented. So that was the judge's ruling, and it is, yes, certainly compact.
Yeah, compact, Delphic, whatever you want to call it. And it may well be that conclusion was the product of a reasoned weighing process, but there's nothing in the record to show whether it was or wasn't. Correct?
Well, that's all it says.
And what is the, under the second prong of Strickland, if there was the term is reasonable probability, right?
Correct.
That doesn't mean a probability in the sense of more likely than not. It means that there's a, non-trivial chance, right, that it could have affected the decision-making calculus on whether to impose death rather than life?
Correct. That's the bottom line. Would it have changed the result?
Well, how do you get to, if you put together the defendant's substantial record of service to his country, his minimal involvement with crime previous to this, and frankly the horrific testimony that was given about the circumstances of his childhood, if the test of Strickland is really essentially that there's a non-trivial chance that it may have affected the calculus in the important determination of whether to give life or death, how do you get there from this record?
How did the judge get there?
Well, I'm trying to get, I don't, from what I understand of Strickland, it's not that you should say, well, I wouldn't have changed my mind, right, necessarily. I mean, that's not even necessarily the second prong of Strickland. It's, is there a reasonable possibility that the outcome would have been different if the mitigation hearing had included this evidence in the first instance, right?
Right.
And given, this is pretty sick stuff about his childhood, right? And wouldn't you agree?
Well, certainly. It's certainly damaging evidence about the parents, and primarily Gerald, but there was also some testimony that I think the mother had slapped some of the foster children.
But it's too, not just the parents, but the effect on the defendant himself of actually being physically abused by his father, of having to watch his father victimize other peers, him trying to protect them, evidence that he manifested behaviors like his father, that his father, in addition to victimizing children, apparently victimized a babysitter, that this went on for years and was covered up.
Well, I guess the bottom line is, would it have made any difference? And part of the problem with introducing this type of testimony is it has to be looked at in total of everything else. I mean, where were you when this evidence would have been presented? Well, it wouldn't have been presented at the guilt phase. I mean, it would come in at the penalty phase. At that point, the jury's already rejected his claim that his wife committed suicide, so he does not have credibility with the jury at that point. And the question is, well, what does all this other evidence do? What would it have done for a reasonable trier of fact? Would it have changed the recommendation from 12 to 0 for death to something less than that? And I think here, and what's not discussed is certainly the aggravating evidence, and the aggravating evidence is very substantial in this case, and that's, I think, what distinguishes it from some other cases where there have been remands or new penalty hearings or something like that, that even if all of that is true, would it have made any difference? And that's the bottom line. But
well,
it's a
and that's the dilemma here, in part because the judge who imposed the death sentence and conducted the proceedings is not the judge who did the Rule 61, and ultimately it's the judge's decision. Now here, faced with a 12-0 vote, no one's surprised that the death penalty was imposed. But you've posed the question correctly. If this mitigating evidence had been presented, would the vote have been something other than 12-0? And faced with a vote other than 12-0, would the sentence have been any different? How do we sort that out?
Well, that's when you're in the realm of speculating. But I think it's important to remember that it's a two-pronged test for ineffective assistance, and that applies whether it's guilt phase or penalty phase. And Strickland said, and I'll quote this just very briefly, it says, if it's easier to dispose of an ineffectiveness claim on the ground of a lack of sufficient prejudice, which we expect will often be the case, that course should be followed. So frequently, instead of worrying about whether counsel's performance was or was not professionally adequate, you can cut right to the prejudice prong. And if you can't show prejudice, it really doesn't matter how bad counsel was. Well, if it's a two-pronged test, then the converse ought to be true, too.
Well, it is, but then there's testimony, and your own brief is actually clearer than your adversaries about the issue the Chief Justice raised, which is, to what extent did the trial team actually see documented evidence of closing, of a closing of the facility by the state? And you cite testimony from Zervis indicating that she saw a document, the last page of which actually does indicate that the home was affirmatively closed by the state, and lists some reasons. Now, she's vague about whether she actually read the page, but if she actually got the document and it said that it was closed, that probably doesn't help you, does it, under the first prong of Strickland? And if she had the document but didn't read it carefully and therefore never followed up on it, does that help you under the first prong of Strickland?
Well, it helps you in the extent that, when did this happen? It happened in 1984, and Gary was already in the Air Force at that point. You know, what was the triggering event? Apparently there was some kind of sexual misconduct that was brought to the attention of the authorities.
So the natural instinct of a defense counsel would be assume, oh, any problems about the home being closed must have emerged after he left it?
Well, I don't know what they would have concluded, but I think a fair reading is that it wasn't brought to the attention of the New York foster authorities until that point, because that's when they closed the foster home. And that's my understanding of what Zervis said, was that she did see that notation. It was in there, but the other records had not been obtained, and that's kind of where they were with all of this. The difficulty, I think, though, is...
Can I ask you something which may be overly broad, but would you agree, by and large, that when you get to the penalty phase in a capital case, if there's any prospect of bringing in mitigating evidence about the trauma or horrors of the defendant's childhood, that that's almost kind of classic something you have to do?
True. Would that be that's correct.
Fair statement?
Yes.
So wouldn't it also follow that effective counsel would be required, no matter what the nature of the crime was, even though this was a more cold and calculating crime than others, but that no matter what the nature of the crime was in a capital case, effective counsel would have to look into and attempt to find any evidence of childhood issues that could be mitigating factors?
Oh, yes, that's certainly incumbent, and that's what they did. They got the school records, the military records, et cetera.
Okay, so what you're saying, if I understand it, is that trial counsel did look into his background. He, of course, denied that there was anything wrong with his childhood. They looked for school records and didn't find indications of truancy or violence or whatever. They called up and spoke to the parents, who both said everything is just wonderful. And having done those things, they had satisfied what was necessary to be competent counsel, in that they looked into childhood trauma and found none.
Well, I think that's what they did, and that's certainly what the defendant's position was. He denied that there was any problem, and he said, you know, his upbringing was fine, and the parents did not indicate to the contrary. That was where they were in this whole investigation.
But I thought that there were a couple of suggestions that were made to trial counsel that, you know, you really ought to look into the fact that he was a foster child for all these years and what that means. Isn't that something that needed to be followed up on?
Well, that's something I think both the psychologist Dr. mentioned, the psychiatrist Dr. Mechanic did point out as potential issues, was the fact that there was this a fairly large succession of foster children, some 33 children over the years. That was out there, but I think the bottom line...
Didn't the father also kind of make a cryptic comment about he wasn't sure his wife would like him bringing up it, and there being this piquant ambiguity about what it was?
Yes, that's true.
Which was also in the mix, but was never followed up on?
Right, that was not followed up on because nobody really knew what it was. I think it was a call from Gerald Plouffe in Florida, I believe, to Linda Zervas, and that's what he said. But
Mr. Williams, can we move back for a moment to the prejudice prong?
Certainly.
And just march away for a minute from the ineffectiveness claim. What can you do to inspire confidence in us that, I'll use the same frame again because I have a very short thesaurus, the pithy statement by the trial judge at the Rule 61 hearing that is supposed to be the basis for us being confident that he weighed the aggravating and the mitigating factors and concluded at the end of the day that even if all of this information had been presented to the original penalty jury, it would not have changed the outcome. Without more, without why the aggravating didn't overwhelm the mitigating, why the mitigating fell short, why should we be confident in his assessment?
Well, I think part of it goes to our hybrid death penalty statute in Delaware. The jury only has an advisory role when you get to this point. Once they found him guilty of first-degree murder and once they have made the unanimous finding that a statutory aggravator, in this case pecuniary gain, exists, then the ultimate decision as to whether he gets death or doesn't get death is up to the judge, and we've had a variety of splits. Closest have been 7-5, where the jury recommended death and death was imposed, and other cases we've had 10-2 for death, and death wasn't imposed. So the judge really does have the final say-so in terms of sentencing. And
but even then, that judge has to show a rational basis after a discussion of the weighing of the aggravating and the mitigating that's subject to appellate review and in which we can have confidence. Tell me why we should have confidence, if we are examining the prejudice prong, that this Rule 61 judge did in fact thoughtfully and carefully weigh the aggravating and mitigating in a way that we can understand and appreciate, in a way that's supported by the record, and be confident that it doesn't have to be done all over again.
Okay, well, I think he weighed it because it's implicit, it's not explicit. And that was the issue that we had in Swan and Norcross. It wasn't an explicit statement. And I don't think you get to the point of saying that it doesn't matter unless you've done this implicit analysis. Now, whether a remand's required or not, I think depends on
how can we review the whether, in fact, there was an analysis or the adequacy of that analysis if it's not put down in writing?
Well, then I think you just have to look at what are you dealing with. You're dealing with a two-part test, and it's the defendant's burden to show ineffective assistance. He has to show both prongs of Strickland. If he can't show the first prong, you don't have to worry about the second prong prejudice. And he did make the finding that counsel's actions, I think he said, the performance fell below the standard of reasonableness. And that's a specific finding, and I think that's certainly supportable by the record. And
if we look at this record, though, and we have trial counsel saying, and we were saving our credibility for the penalty phase, and then the question raised by the Rule 61 evidence is, well, if you were saving your credibility for the penalty phase, how did you miss all of this?
Well, the question is, what did you miss and what difference would it make? And the problem with presenting this type of evidence is a jury may very well just conclude that, okay, this is the psychological phenomenon modeling that Gary learned to abuse people because he saw his father abusing females, and that's why he committed this homicide, at least in part, in addition to the $100,000 life insurance policy. That's not helpful. The other problem is the way this was presented at the Rule 61 hearing was these witnesses, the foster children, testified, and then a psychiatrist, Dr. Pablo Stewart, came in and testified, and he said, well, I don't know if he spoke personally with these foster children or just was apprised of what their testimony was going to be at the Rule 61. And he wove all this together and said, well, the reason that Gary told this crazy story about suicide was because he was in, and his phrase was, a phenomena of denial. There was a phenomena of denial at the Plouffe house where Gary grew up. Everybody was denying that any abuse or anything untoward was happening. And because of this, he said Gary lacked the ability to tell the truth. Now, I didn't really understand why that would be helpful. The jury's already rejected his story about the suicide at the guilt phase. Bringing that in, even if you saved it for the penalty phase, I mean, I think a reasonable juror could say, well, wait a minute. You defendants, you put on this defense, and now you're bringing in an expert psychiatrist who's saying on the basis of this horrific upbringing that he lacks the ability to tell the truth, and that's why he made up this story about the suicide. I just don't think that's going to sell to a jury, and I don't think you show prejudice by doing that.
But again, isn't the analysis under Strickland is not for the court to say, I personally wouldn't have voted differently, but is it possible the jury could say, this dude did a really sick, horrible act. He lied about it. Doesn't make us happy about him. Now, though, we've heard the full picture of him, we take into account that he served his country with distinction in the military, overseas, won medals in difficult tours of duty. And we look at the childhood we have, and while we wouldn't want him out on the street, it actually makes us a little less surprised by his actions when we recognize how fundamentally horrible his childhood is, the moral role models that he had, which were immoral role models. And in the calculus where we have to weigh all the factors closely, life or death, we're going to recommend life, or even that it's 6-6 or 7-5, how under Strickland do I get to your point, which is that, no, it just wouldn't have mattered?
Well, because, you know, the other good evidence you point to is he did have 19 and a half years of very commendable service. He had served in Bosnia and Saudi Arabia. He had fairly good evaluation, performances evaluations. He had one disciplinary problem when he was in the service, although it was actually something that had not occurred at the airbase, but an extramarital affair with a co-worker's wife, and he got written up for that. But if he was that adversely affected and couldn't tell the truth and made up all this, why wasn't that manifested in his other daily living? And there isn't any evidence that it was. There was evidence that he stole a tractor and that he had been charged with a third degree of assault of a girlfriend, but that had not resulted in a conviction. So that's all there was. The evidence was that he seemed to be a fairly normal functioning person doing a very good job at the airbase.
And perhaps those other factors would explain why the trial judge might have determined that finding out about his terrible childhood really wouldn't have made a difference. He managed to overcome that childhood well enough to be a functioning member of the armed services and so forth, and therefore it wouldn't have changed the result. But we don't know that.
Well, you don't know that, and I guess, you know, as I say, when you're looking at these reweighing the evidence, Wiggins and Porter and some of the other cases say, you're necessarily involved in speculation, and that's kind of what it is.
Right, but we don't even know what the trial judge speculated, do we?
What the trial judge said? You mean back in 2003?
No, what I'm saying is in deciding now that there's no prejudice, the trial court said that this information wouldn't have made a difference.
Yes.
And you just suggested that a possibility for why this information wouldn't have made a difference is that he got past his childhood and he was functioning well as an adult and served in the armed forces and so forth. So finding out that he had a tough childhood really wouldn't have had much impact. Well, that obviously is speculation, but it also is a potential explanation for why the trial court decided that it wouldn't have made a difference. However, the trial court didn't say that or anything else.
No, it's not, you know, explicitly stated beyond what's there, but I think what you do have is he's 19 and a half years out of the house. He enlisted shortly after his high school graduation. He really hasn't been back to the home for any substantial period of time since he left and joined the Air Force and had been stationed at various locations and overseas deployments. He was working a part-time job. He certainly seemed to be functioning fine. The problem was when this $100,000 life insurance policy for the spouses came about, and that was announced in August, and his homicide occurs November 3rd, 2 days after the policy went into effect. Suddenly he's got a solution to all of his financial problems, and there was testimony about the child support he was paying for his three children, and he had told a coworker shortly before all this that soon his financial problems would be over. That's certainly evidence that he's planning to solve it.
Is your position that there would have been no legal room of discretion that would have permitted a judge of the Superior Court to have actually given any sentence other than death?
No, there's certainly room. I mean, it's up to the judge. You know, I don't know that
I'm not sure there's unlimited discretion.
Well, there may not be unlimited, but I don't know there's...
I'm still trying to get at your sense of what the second prong of Strickland requires us to assess in terms of... I think a lot of us are struggling with is that the judge clearly did not do a de novo sentencing weighing of the mitigating versus factors. So he applied the second prong of Strickland and then just said it wouldn't have affected the outcome.
And I think that's the bottom line. Is there a reasonable probability?
Strickland, yeah, that's the question. What is the increment, which is if you could conclude that it could have affected the sentencing calculus of a reasonable judge, isn't that enough under Strickland? Not that it would have, but that there's a non-trivial chance that it could have affected, right?
Well, I don't know if it's non-trivial or reasonable probability is the phrase.
What do you mean by reasonable probability?
Well, the way the court decisions have defined it is that it would have changed the result. He would not have got the death sentence.
I think the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, said it's a substantial, not just conceivable, likelihood of a different result. But are you saying substantial means that it's more likely than not that there would have been a different result?
More likely than not. Well, I guess that translates to reasonable probability. That seems to be an equivalency, yes.
Well, that sounds like something we're going to have to figure out, but thank you for your help, Mr. Okay, Andrew. Your time is up.
And my time is almost up, but I'll go as quickly as I can. I thought the state actually articulated the phenomena of denial better than I did, but that certainly would have been an extremely important mitigator had it been presented at trial and would have explained a lot about the whole denial and suicide theory and things like that, and I think would have really resonated with the jury along with the military and abuse evidence. The court was just talking about the standard and reasonable probability. I tend to articulate, I latch on to the phrase undermine confidence in the outcome per Strickland and everything that followed Strickland. And how can there be confidence in an outcome where a jury was only given a small fraction of what they needed in order to effectively assess Mr. Plouffe's moral culpability for this crime? They basically didn't get the whole story, and therefore there can't be confidence in the outcome that occurred. To the Chancellor's point with respect to the record, Your Honor, I did look at the transcript, and for the record, it's page A369 of the appendix, and it's Ms. Zervis does say she did not have that report indicating that the foster home was closed prior to trial. She had one that said everything was fine but did not have the new one. And she said if she had had that report, that she certainly would have brought it to the attention of trial counsel, which again underscores the crucial importance of obtaining records, a basic duty of counsel in a death penalty case. Am I into my extra time, Your Honor? I think I'm on the red.
Your problem is you have no extra time.
I'm actually over time.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you to the court.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement for recess.
Please rise.